Hello, I'm Bruce Edwards, and welcome to this podcast produced by the International Monetary Fund. In today's program, Professor Douglas Irwin tells us why trade matters.
When you get to this moment where people are concerned about jobs in manufacturing or what have you, if there's a trade agreement on the table, which is the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership at the moment, that will be the focus point of domestic political controversy.
Global trade has been the subject of a heated political controversy of late, but how do changes in global trade really affect the average person? Douglas Irwin joined in a panel discussion on the topic during the 2016 IMF World Bank annual meetings. Irwin is the John Sloan Dickey Third Century Professor in Social Sciences in the Department of Economics at Dartmouth College and author of several books on free trade. Reporter Mark Betancourt sat down with Douglas Irwin and began by asking him where global trade stands today.
Since the financial crisis, when world trade took a major hit and fell dramatically, world trade growth has been fairly slow. Now, that largely reflects the fact that the world economies are growing much slower than they did before the crisis. But still, it's been viewed as not a good sign for the health of the world economy, and to the extent that it reflects the fact that trade barriers are actually creeping back, it's a very bad sign. So that's one area of concern. The other area of concern, of course, is who's getting the benefits of the trade that we've seen and the globalization that's taken place over the past two decades. And here it varies quite a bit by countries. So a lot of countries have grown rapidly and have pulled a lot of people out of poverty. The poverty reduction has been massive in the world economy over the past 25 years or so, much beyond, I think, the hopes of most people at the World Bank and the IMF 20 years ago. And trade's been a very important factor in that. So when you look at India or China or a lot of the emerging markets and other countries in the developing world, they've done very well. In some cases, inequality has increased in those countries. In other cases, it's actually gone down, but it's a very much a mixed bag. But then in the industrialized economies, particularly the United States and Western Europe, you see increased polarization over trade and globalization. A lot of it has to do with migration and immigration, but some of it has to do with trade as well.
So you mean polarization in terms of political polarization, like what people think of trade?
Exactly. So if you look at public opinion polls, at least in the United States, people are still favorable towards globalization overall, a little bit more skeptical towards trade agreements, also skeptical about immigration. It's hard to disentangle what elements of globalization are causing the most problems for people, at least as in terms of how they perceive it. But I think when you look at Britain, say, in the Brexit vote, it was much more related to migration than it was to trade. It wasn't anti-trade backlash. But then again, on continental Europe and in Germany, you see a lot of protests against TTIP, the Transatlantic Partnership, Trade Investment Partnership. So there's not a sense that they necessarily want to roll back globalization, but they certainly don't want to proceed or are skeptical of some of the trade agreements that they see coming down the pike.
In general, is there a discrepancy between people's perceptions of how global trade is affecting them and maybe the reality of how it's affecting them? Obviously, in the Brexit situation, a lot of people would argue that Britain's gave up one of their economic advantages.
Yeah, and what's interesting about the Brexit vote is that the heaviest vote to leave the European Union was in places where the migrants were not going. In the U.S., once again, it's a little bit different because we have had some depressed areas of the country, the Rust Belt, the Appalachian area as well. But there, there's a lot of other things going on, a lot of technological change, a lot of movement of manufacturing jobs from the north to the south. And technology has a big role, too. But people conflate trade and technology a lot because you can blame other countries for taking our jobs. It's very hard to blame a computer or a machine or a robot from taking your job.
How does technology sort of change the game in terms of trade? It's not just this physical flow one direction or another, either of migration in terms of labor or in terms of goods. Is there sort of a muddling of the way we've done trade up until now? I guess is there a way we need to even think of trade differently because of how quickly technology is moving?
Well, we do, because we haven't seen any big real trade agreements since the last multilateral trade agreement was in 1994, the Uruguay round that the WTO membership reached. And that's the pre-internet era. So there's a lot of digital commerce, e-commerce, and a lot of creeping regulations that countries are imposing about data localization and restrictions on internet transfer and free speech on the internet or things of that sort. So technology sort of marches ahead regardless of the trade agreements. But I think when you get to this moment where people are concerned about jobs in manufacturing or what have you, it doesn't matter whether it's trade or technology. If there's a trade agreement on the table, which is the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership at the moment, that will be the focus point of domestic political controversy.
What people who oppose agreements like the TPP here often say is that they're losing their jobs, that basically jobs are going to go flow out of the United States and go somewhere else. Can you give us some sense of how that actually fits into the effects of an agreement like that?
Well, TPP, like a lot of previous agreements from the U.S. perspective, is opening up foreign markets for the United States. The United States is already a fairly open economy. We're not cutting our tariffs, really. We're not opening up our market significantly. But when you look at Vietnam, Japan, they have very high tariffs, certainly on agricultural goods, and then Vietnam in the case of manufactured goods.
So when you say opening up, you mean basically lowering the taxes for imports there so that goods can be shipped to those countries?
Exactly. And then there's, of course, a lot of provisions about disciplining the state-owned enterprises in Vietnam, limiting the number of subsidies they can get, which presumably would help American firms. Also regulatory harmonization, so they can't just arbitrarily restrict U.S. exports of agricultural goods on health and safety grounds. They have to provide some basis for that. So I think the perception, once again, of the agreements is that, oh, now we're going to be importing a lot more from these countries. When you look at the details of the agreement, a lot of it is just facilitating commerce both ways and oftentimes more in the favor of the United States in terms of getting access to markets overseas.
Going forward, obviously globalization and open trade has actually benefited lower-income people around the world because they just have more access to the markets one way or another. They have more ways of making money, potentially. Is that a trend that is going to continue just as a result of sort of the natural process of globalization and interconnectedness becoming more and more interconnected? Or does that need to be a concerted effort on the part of these nations who are entering into these agreements with each other to make that something that's inclusive?
It's both. So certainly it's those regions of the world and those countries of the world that have embraced globalization the most that you've seen the biggest reduction in poverty. So when you look at the Middle East or North Africa or big parts of Africa, they haven't been connected to global markets, either because of trade barriers or other barriers, natural barriers. And there's a lot of transactions costs, political uncertainty, infrastructure failures that prevent trade from taking place.
So basically reasons why businesses would not want to do business there.
Exactly. So if for a typical African country, you know, they can reduce their tariff and get into a trade agreement, but if your ports don't work well, if your customs officials are corrupt, you're not going to see a lot of trade.
So this is essentially the intersection between development and international trade, is that you have to bring everybody up to the same level so that the playing field is level kind of regardless of what the agreements are.
Absolutely. So it's not just a matter of trade agreements by any stretch of the imagination, because that's not the major impediment to what's going on. It's failure of business to invest in Africa and get products to market.
So getting back to the sort of political issue and the issue of political perception of trade, how do we approach getting people to understand how these agreements might benefit them or how they just might affect them better than they do? Because obviously there are a lot of misperceptions out there.
Yeah, it's obviously a very difficult thing to do. You know, once again, those countries that have embraced globalization have tended to do a lot better. So there's always the examples you can point to. There's sort of two sides to the coin from an economist's perspective. There's the gains from trade, and then there's costs of trade restrictions. And unfortunately, the costs of trade restrictions are much more apparent. So then the gains from trade, which seem to be relatively diffuse, you know, we get our iPhones a little bit cheaper because of trade and this, that, and the other thing. The benefits are spread among so many people. It's the productivity of certain firms that succeed and can serve their customers well. If people don't like that and they want to retreat, the problem is that once you start imposing trade barriers, then you can actually see the costs. The costs become very apparent in terms of higher prices, less trade, firms can't source inputs, they become less efficient. And so you hate to say that you need some countries imposing trade barriers to show everyone the problems with going down that route, but sometimes that might have to happen.
So really sort of slow and steady wins the race is the idea to keep opening things gradually but under a set of rules.
There's a recent quote I saw that said, no nation can succeed trying to protect the past from the future. So the world is becoming more integrated whether we like it or not. The question with these trade agreements is just what sort of rules are we going to have to govern that?
That was Douglas Irwin, John Sloan Dickey, third century professor in social sciences in the Department of Economics at Dartmouth College, with some insights on how international trade actually affects people, despite what they think. You can watch the webcast of the IMF World Bank annual meeting seminar entitled Making Trade an Engine of Growth for All at imf.org. You can also hear more podcasts while you're there or search for IMF Podcasts on your favorite podcast app.